Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. You know, for years and years, one of our biggest wars has been, did the Warriors with KD ruin the NBA? And I'm not here to concede. I'm not here to give an inch. However, this past weekend, I found myself doing something I did not quite expect, and that's enjoying college basketball. And I started to think, why am I watching so many of these college basketball games? It's like, oh yeah, all the good teams in the NBA have pretty much given up because of injuries. They're just waiting till the playoffs. And we've got like 10 or 12 teams completely tanking, and their games are, you know, essentially unwatchable. So the gap between the entertainment value in the NBA and the entertainment value in some of these admittedly terrible college basketball games over the weekend was not nearly as wide as it usually is. And I don't want to give you credit because that pains me when I have to give you credit. But I do think there's something here, right? Like, is my eye straying away from the NBA because the dog days are even doggier than they usually are in the NBA?
That's a good way to put it. The dog days are a little doggier than normal. I think you're right. The tanking part of it, there are like 9 or 10 teams that are openly punting on the final 6 weeks of the season. And we're going to talk more about tanking later in the episode. But I think that's part of what's removed the drama, because even some of the teams that are streaking are beating like tanking teams that are maybe half an NBA roster. And so it's harder to enjoy. But I also think you're dancing around the real truth of it, which is that the tournament is fun. And that's hard for NBA elitists like you to admit. But I will say from my own experience, I had a lot more fun than I expected watching college basketball, even as I tuned in and was like, oh my God, I can't believe how bad the officiating is. Like, watching Syracuse's defense was awful yesterday, and like there are a lot of problems in college hoops, but in general I had a lot of fun this weekend.
Yeah, it was like being reacquainted at a 10-year reunion for me, because it's been an awful while since I really dug in at all to college basketball. I mean, you're seeing like presses, you know, full court presses. Like, good luck trying to pull that off in the NBA. That wouldn't work. Like you're saying, the 2-3 zone, that's not going to succeed in limiting teams to what, like 20% shooting or whatever Michigan State managed. I mean, it's just a different sport. It was an entertaining basketball weekend, highlighted by, I think, you know, outside of UMBC, which, by the way, University of Maryland, Baltimore County has always bothered me, similar to like South Carolina upstate. Remember when we had that discussion in like the Fifth Third Bank in Michigan, where the names are just a little bit off? Like, University of Maryland, Baltimore County has always, just kind of been one of those things that, like, you know, stuck in my craw. But huge win for them. I think that really symbolizes the whole tournament, right? I mean, if you have a 16 taking down a 1, you have their Twitter guy becoming this like international celebrity overnight. Of course, they go out, but no one even cares. I think that's why people like college basketball. And I will admit, and it's hard to admit, that I did get caught up into it, because the NBA product, if it's not teams that are tanking, it's teams that are punting games against teams that are trying. So those games are all ruined. And then, like I said, the teams at the top, you know, outside of that great Raptors, Thunder game this weekend, there's just not a lot going on.
Yeah, there's not a lot of action. We do have a lot to get to today, so we should jump into it, because we have one NCAA tournament thought at the top and then a lot of NBA stuff to run through. So we'll start with Jameson, who hit me up on Twitter and said, "Sharp, you picked the wrong Michigan team. Hashtag hail." And I just want to congratulate you for picking the right Michigan team. Like I said, watching Michigan State Syracuse on Sunday made me tear my hair out. I can't believe how badly Tom Izzo coached that game. Like, half the reason I picked Michigan State was because I thought Jared Jackson was going to become like the breakout star of the tournament. And he was benched for most of the final like 10 minutes of that game. And I just had to watch Miles Bridges brick threes. Like, it was awful. But the flip side of it is your Michigan Wolverines were, like you said, the second best story of the weekend. I think nobody's unseating UMBC, but that Jordan Poole game winner was unbelievable. So what's your reaction? Where's your head at right now?
Yeah, well, that was I'm still kind of getting over your initial statement, which is that you picked the wrong Michigan team. Look, Andrew, there's only one Michigan team. There's State, you know, but there's also Michigan. It's not really a decision here. So, you know, that was your own mistake. That's a lifelong mistake, I think. You know, you should have been riding with the blue and maize. The shot was ridiculous. I was fully prepared for them to lose that game. It was not the world's best game either, but the way it finished was insane. Did you see the video showing him from high school and then in college where he has that spread eagle, crazy, like, splayed legs, three-point buzzer beater, like, when he was in high school and then again at Michigan? Pretty insane. That's like his signature move. Whose signature move is a splayed leg 30-footer to win games? I've never heard of that.
Yeah,
for a freshman, that's pretty awesome.
You loved that most of all because he did the Jumpman pose as he was shooting it. And it just like goes back to your Jordan standing. And like that was cool for 100 different reasons. And Jordan is like number 99 on the list.
I'm just saying, it's a pretty ridiculous signature move for him to have. And his name is Jordan, which is like to tie it all off. And Michigan, sure. You know, they're the first football team that won the Jordan jersey. So it just came full circle. If Jordan Brand does not have a t-shirt that's like some March Madness themed t-shirt with his silhouette of that shot, they're missing out on a major revenue opportunity. That's a free one. I'm just going to hand that one to them for free.
Yeah.
No, it was great. You know what I was really hoping for, though, Andrew, to be honest, was the Open Floor Bowl. I wanted Michigan versus North Carolina in the Sweet 16 here in L.A., and the Tar Heels could not get it done. They got ran off the court, and I was so certain after that Michigan game winner, I was like, yes, it's going to be sort of like we're the governors. Like, you know, I'd be the governor of Michigan, and you'd be the governor of North Carolina, and we'd have to make some sort of a bet, like, you know, like cherries versus, you know, whatever Virginia's known for, tobacco leaves or something like that. You know, we have to have some sort of a, you know, a major open floor stakes bet on it. But alas, you know, UNC fizzled out of the tournament.
The dream died.
Yeah.
Look, it was, I have a couple final thoughts on the tournament. Number one, I finished watching the Michigan State game when watching my title pick go down in flames. And immediately texted one of my friends who's a diehard Michigan State fan and was like, you know what? It's all right. Just hop on the bandwagon with Luke May and Joel Berry and run with the winners. And then like 5 minutes after that, UNC was down 20 to Texas A&M. And I was just like, man, it's time to shift into NBA playoffs mode. I'm done with the tournament. And then the other thing, nobody wants to hear anyone talk about their brackets, but my bracket is disastrous for one specific reason, because I betrayed my like foundational principles as a college basketball fan or observer. I wouldn't necessarily call myself a fan, but like for the last 5 years, I have relentlessly made fun of UVA basketball. They are like the Hawks of college basketball, and at every turn, I was shorting their stock. I never put faith in them, and I've come into contact with more UVA people over the last few years. Like I've got a friend named Jack who teaches there. My wife went to business school there. Like there, so I've got a lot of like wahoos in my life. And out of sympathy for them, I picked UVA to make the finals of the NCAA tournament this year, which is just, it goes against everything I believe in. And that obviously was a disaster. And then also, I want to say I have always loved John Boeheim's Michigan teams. They play the most enjoyable like brand of basketball in college hoops. And so I'm really happy for you. And if anything, I feel like you should be repping those Michigan teams more, because year after year, they play some of the most entertaining basketball in the country.
No, I hear you. I'm still just scarred from the whole like Fab Five scandal. You know, like it seemed like any sport in which Juwan Howard, Jalen Rose, and Chris Webber couldn't thrive and just couldn't, you know, get by and do whatever they wanted.
It's a red
wasn't
flag,
a sport
yeah.
that wasn't a sport I wanted to be affiliated with in any way. So it's been a slow process to get back into the fold. You're talking about how great Beeline is. I have a question for you though.
What?
Syracuse. I mean, Boeheim obviously is like a college basketball god, but it seems like to enjoy what they're doing, you have to be on like the ultimate high horse. So here's my question, because you straddle both these worlds. Are the college high horses significantly worse than the pro high horses? Because like in the pros, What you're saying about Michigan, hey, they're playing a smart way. They know how to shoot threes. Like, they're forward thinking. That's sort of the high horse, right?
Yeah.
But in college, it's like, we have to take all the fun out of the game. We're going to milk the clock. We're probably going to argue when they try to shorten the shot clock to say, no, we need to have the traditionalist way of doing it. You probably want to go back to like the box and one strategy, right, if you could. And then they play this 2-3 zone, which the whole point is just deflection. It's like all they're trying to do in the entire world, like their main goal in life. They don't even want to score points. They just want to get as many deflections as possible and ruin your life.
Yeah.
And they sucked all the fun out of a Michigan State team, which was talented, like you mentioned last week. Had a lot of interesting pro prospects, none of them who could do anything. It seems to me like the college high horse is definitely worse than the pro high horse. Am I right?
I think there's no question about that. And I never want to watch a Syracuse game again, because keep in mind, they've been doing this for like 5 or 6 years. Like 3 or 4 years ago, I think they made a Final Four again with a team that just had like absolutely no offensive talent. It was the year that Malachi Richardson like played his way into the middle of the first round and was never heard from again. But like, I can't stand Syracuse basketball, but Michigan is the antidote. So together, you and I, we can ride this Michigan bandwagon as far as it goes for the rest of March.
Yeah, they're probably going out next round now that you're on board, but that's
yeah.
Fine. Hey,
fine,
man.
Famous last words.
No question. And look, I was pretty sure I had jinxed them, by the way. Before he hit that game winner, I was like, I never should have talked about them on the podcast. What a disaster that was.
Yeah,
but
well,
let's get to NBA talk, man. We've dabbled thoroughly. We stuck our foot in the pond, or whatever that phrase is, with college basketball. Let's get to
yes,
some real hoops.
And literally no one in the open floor globe is tuning in to hear us talk about college basketball. So we can move on here. Kinley says, are the growing lists of injuries to key players on the Warriors and Celtics a legitimate area of concern going down the stretch and into the playoffs? I think we also need to add the Cavs to this list, because before we came on to record, this is Monday afternoon, news broke that Ty Lue is stepping away from coaching for an indefinite period of time. And even beyond the Ty Lue news, like, the Cavs have been missing half their roster for most of the last couple weeks. And I don't know. My first reaction is yes. The injuries should be concerning to the Warriors and the Celtics and the Cavs. And it really changes the narrative, because like for most of this season, Golden State and Cleveland have been considered foregone conclusions. Golden State, obviously, more so than Cleveland. And the Celtics were considered a foregone conclusion to be like challenging in the East. But like, all these teams should be pretty freaked out. We're not that far away from the playoffs here.
Andrew, are you really going to sit there and suggest that health is important to winning? Are you really going to make such a bold, ostentatious claim?
Not the hottest take. I'm not saying that it's some sort of bold proclamation, but like, I think you and I, when we were talking about the Warriors after Steph's injury, neither one of us were that concerned about the bigger picture. But now, literally, like, Steph, Clay, and KD are out. Draymond hasn't looked healthy for most of the year. And then, I mean, that's before you even look at the Cavs. And like, the Celtics without Marcus Smart haven't been the same team. I mean, I don't know. There are a lot of real red flags here.
There definitely are. I mean, to me, one of the turning points, Andrew, was actually Clay going down, in part because Clay's had basically enjoyed perfect health for and availability for his entire career.
Forever.
As you and I know, the greatest ability is availability. Klay Thompson, prior to his recent thumb injury, had appeared in 97.6% of the Warriors' regular season games during his career, and he had never missed a playoff game throughout all of their runs, right? So this is the guy you bank on. So when he goes down, even if it's only for a couple weeks, it should shake everybody up, including us, and it should shake us out of our assumptions that, oh, Golden State's just going to waltz. You throw on top Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, some of the other injury issues they've had there. You know, it's not like, you know, a 5-alarm fire here, but it's certainly something to monitor, because during their title runs, they've enjoyed great health. And during the title that they lost, they did not enjoy such great health. So that tells you everything you need to know about the importance of health. I do kind of feel bad, or at least empathetic a little bit towards Clay, though, Andrew, because it seems like usually when stars go out on their teams, we all have this huge conversation about, oh, let's see what they look like when they're not out there. We can really see what that player's true impact is. We can really come to appreciate them in a new way. poor Klay is like still overshadowed by Durant and Curry on the injury list. Like he can't even get his true shine because his other, you know, more famous and more, acclaimed teammates are also hurt right now. But
not only that, I think maybe we should start rethinking how valuable Klay and Steph really are, because I don't know about you, but I've watched some of these Warriors games. Nick Young stepped right into Klay's shoes. He's draining threes.
Whoa,
and Quinn Cook had 28 and 5 threes the other night, filling in for Steph. I don't know. Maybe Steph Curry is a system player.
Wow, I hope you're being sarcastic, because otherwise we'd have to run.
I'm being extremely sarcastic. It's
we'd
all
have
good.
To run back 18 months of screaming at each other. But I think usually what you want to do here is, okay, who's peaking at the right time, right? Who's enjoyed good health? Who's got good momentum? And the flip side of this conversation, it's pretty much what? Houston and Toronto.
Yeah.
And I think those are two teams. Like, we did the overrated, underrated thing, you know, not too long ago in terms of the contenders. And a big variable in why I think both those teams probably still have a better shot at reaching the finals than the average viewer would assume is because of their good health. That can overcome stuff like, you know, poor postseason history in years past. That can overcome things like matchup issues. If you don't have to match up with Kevin Durant, all of a sudden, you know, that matchup issue is not going to be fatal
totally.
For you. So, I think these are concerns. We should absolutely monitor them carefully. It's probably the biggest story, frankly. Boston, Cleveland, and Golden State's health is probably the biggest NBA story over the next month.
So let's hit some of these other teams then. I mean, what do you think of the Cavs right now? Granted, we have like maybe 15% of the information on Ty Lue, but like, what's your reaction to what we're seeing with them?
I've already been worried, and you told me it wasn't going to be a problem. So I'm going to welcome you to reopen your mind now that Kinley got through to you with this email. No, I think the tricky part for them is they've never had a situation with this group all together and all clicking on the same cylinder. So it's not like they can get back to how they know they can play. Like, if you're Golden State, you can always turn back to the, you know, mentally, you can say, look, we went 16-1 last year's playoffs. As long as we've got our guys out there at 75% or above, you know, we know how to do this. You have all those shared reps. Cleveland has basically no shared reps among their main guys. And LeBron's basically out here begging for talent. Like, he went through Portland and was like, yeah, give me Damian Lillard. He won't be underrated anymore. He won't be underappreciated anymore. He's like, man, it's been a while since I played with an all-star. I can't wait for Kevin Love to get back. I mean, these are the kinds of things he's putting out there. And these are the exact same things you'd say, too, if you were running out of time during the regular season and if you were sick of playing with guys like Jeff Green every single night for like 30-plus minutes, you know?
You know what else LeBron is doing that's it's a little bit lame is for a couple weeks now, he'll have a viral moment during a Cavs game. Like, the pass against the Lakers, the dunk on Nurkic, and then he'll post on Instagram, like, a photo of him or a video of him making that play that went viral, and there's no acknowledgement that the Cavs lost both of those games like pretty handily, and it's a little bit lame for LeBron to come out and be like, yup, I'm the greatest player alive, as the Cavs are like really pissing away the final third of this season, which again isn't really his fault because the pieces aren't there, but it's something I've noticed. And in addition, I echo all your concerns. And the main thing is I don't like talking about the Cavs' concerns because all of this can flip so quickly. But yeah, like, the red flags there are real. And some of the Ty Lue details are pretty scary, and I'm glad he stepped away. I had no idea that he was going through that. But like, chest pains, not sleeping, like, it's definitely seems like the right thing for him to take as much time as he needs to get right.
Yeah, no question. Hey, you don't gram through the pain, Andrew? I mean, doesn't everybody do that?
I
mean,
isn't I guess that... so. Maybe that's
Look,
what he's
what do
doing.
You, what do you want him to do? Like, you want him to post highlights that are going to generate hundreds of thousands of clicks and be a happy guy? Or do you want him to put up Arthur memes? You know,
that's
I mean, I
fair.
Think...
That's fair. That's self-care for LeBron. Good for him.
I think it is a little bit of self-care, and I think also, you know, there's a worse alternative, you know? What if he was trashing his teammates? You know, what if he was doing the subtle jabs? I mean, it's one thing when you're pushing guys like Kevin Love and Kyrie's buttons, when you're trying to play Zen Master, and LeBron's done that in the past. I think at a certain point, the talent on Cleveland's roster after these injuries has gotten so low. You can Zen master for a decade, Andrew. You're never going to push Jeff Green's buttons. You're never going to pull the real player out of Jeff Green. You know what I mean?
You know what? Jeff Green has been perfectly fine for Cleveland. Jeff Green is not the problem for the Cavs. I think he's taken a lot of shit over the years, and he doesn't necessarily deserve it this year. But your broader point is spot on, so I'm not going to argue with you.
I shouldn't have picked on the DMV product. My bad. I'm just exactly, saying, you know, like,
exactly.
He's same rule applies for Jose Calderon or whoever else you want to throw into this mix, right? I mean, there's only so much manipulation that's going to work, and I think once LeBron's not playing the mind games, what else does he have besides his highlights? I don't begrudge him the grams, Andrew. I'm just going to say that.
Yeah. No, you're right that on the spectrum of, like, kind of suspect LeBron social media behavior, this is on the more positive side, and we should all be grateful that he's not. And my favorite moment of the last couple years was that time when, like, the Cavs were in the middle of another losing streak, and he went on Instagram and posted a, like, cartoon of himself as a depressed Batman, and it was one of the best moments in NBA Twitter history over the last couple years. So people, go Google that and just appreciate that really happened. The last thing we should say on the Celtics, I think that there are legitimate reasons for concern, obviously, but I do think that we're beginning to underrate the Celtics as we, like, approach the playoffs. They're going to be really tough. If there's a real reason for concern in Boston, it's Kyrie's knee over the long term would have me a little bit stressed out if I were a Celtics fan. Like, Danny Ainge sort of quietly mentioned that Kyrie might need surgery this summer on the knee just to, like, clean things up. And I don't know. I mean, he's someone who's had injuries over the course of his career and has been relatively healthy over the last year or two. But it's something to watch if you're in Boston. But I do think that in the next couple months, we're going to see them surge again, and people are going to be like, "Oh shit! I guess the Celtics are still good." So,
yeah, you're talking like somebody who has experience with this firsthand. I mean,
yeah, I don't know. Cleaning up knees is never a good thing. I'm just saying. But we have one more question in Golden State. Matt says, "I just watched the Warriors lose at home to the Kings. Can we officially stick a fork in any top 10 talk for Draymond? He's a good player, don't get me wrong. He made a lot of decent plays that kept his team in the game. But with Draymond and his AAA cousin, Al Horford, can we at least agree that it's a lot easier to be a hashtag winning player that makes hashtag winning plays when you play for a great coach with other great players?" So listen, you're the master of the rankings, the keeper of the top 100. So I'll let you handle this at the start.
See, look, this is the real secret to how you get your question read at openfloormail@gmail.com. You know, you just send in a question you know I will flip out about, and Sharp will just serve it up on a platter. I mean, it's just the most obvious formula of all time. Andrew, are you telling me we're supposed to judge Draymond Green's entire stature in the NBA off one game in which half of his teammates are not playing against the Sacramento Kings in March? Does that sound like a good strategy for judging Draymond Green?
Excuse me.
That sounds
not
like
what I'm telling you.
An
that's
insult.
Not at all
that sounds
what
like
saying.
An insult to Draymond Green. That's what it sounds like.
No, that's not what I'm saying. And honestly, I didn't even watch the Kings game. But this is something that I have thought about over the years and or over the course of this season. I think Draymond may be a little bit overrated. And granted, he hasn't been quite the same guy this season. So maybe that's part of it too. I just think there are 9 or 10 players who by themselves can make a team good, and I don't think that Draymond is in that conversation. I think that he is awesome and he's also the type of guy who unlocks all sorts of possibilities for a good team, and that's why he should be ranked in the top 20. But I think this may have been a case where, like, groupthink on basketball Twitter has collectively, like, inflated his value beyond what's reasonable.
Or it may have been a case that he played an integral role in them winning basically 70 games for 3 straight seasons, and you have to give credit
fair.
When guys
sure.
do that. Could have been a case of that too, right? How many of your guys in this so-called top 8 or 9 are elite defensive players, Andrew?
I would say I'm looking at it because I actually put together a list of my top 15 right now, and so I would say Anthony Davis, Giannis, and Kawhi Leonard are the three of my top eight that are elite defensive players. And you could include KD in that conversation if you wanted to.
Okay, but none of them are defense first players. So let me guess, Rudy Gobert is not in your top 15?
No, Rudy Gobert is, and actually I think he's the most interesting debate with Draymond. It's whether you would rather have Rudy Gobert or Draymond. And I think you still go Draymond just because of the small ball stuff that he opens up. But like, Draymond's shooting has been really rough this year, and that's mostly on wide open looks too. So I mean, I think he still opens up all the small ball stuff, but he's less effective in that role than he has been.
Yeah, remember, Draymond's a passer before he's a scorer. I think some people still kind of mistake that. I'm not saying you are, but other people, when they're judging Draymond, his major positive benefit on offense is his ability to move everywhere on the court and then to open things up as a playmaker, and also to take off and to set your
from the three.
Yep, and exactly. To set your pace in transition, grab a defensive rebound and go, right? And so I think, first of all, is he slightly overrated by the intelligent basketball fan? That's definitely possible. I would say he hasn't played consistently as a top 10 player during this regular season. I expect after the playoffs for him to be back in that conversation? I do. I think he can crank it up just like the Warriors in general can crank it up. Do I think he's still vastly underrated by people who like to throw around, you know, mocking hashtag winning player as the emailer did? Yes, I think he's still vastly underrated by those people. Do I think he is hated on more than almost every superstar in the NBA because of his, you know, frankly, his obnoxious personality at times? Yes, I do. I mean, I think he cultivates that. He cultivates that hate. And I think that plays a bigger factor in how people view Draymond than, you know, the stat nerds or the all-around RPM, you know, real plus-minus guys like myself who are saying, hey, this guy deserves to be in the conversation. Like, you touched on it with the Rudy Gobert comparison. It's the versatility, you know, both positionally but also stylistically that kind of helps Draymond, right? So you could play him at the four or the five. You could play up or down. You could play slow if you wanted. If you're taking Rudy Gobert as your franchise guy, the Jazz fans and their media members recently have been all over this hype train saying he needs to be a top 10 guy. You know, it's a fascinating test case because he is that defensive first type player and his value is so obvious there. But you're committing to a specific style of play with him, right? Like, you have to play one way and you have to find guys who can fit with him. With Draymond, I think it's a little bit more flexible and, you know, it's easier to kind of build around him. So when I'm drafting in a, you know, a vacuum test, I would still take Draymond over Gobert, but not by a ton. I also think the point you've made before about Draymond's value, we should keep a very close eye on it, because if anyone from that big four is going to fall off because of age, it's going to be Draymond. I think he's going to be the first to go. And when he goes, it will be interesting to see how graceful that is. Like, is he still able to kind of like fit into a more narrow role on offense? You know, sort of like Iguodala has, you know, scale back your offense and save your energy, conserve your impact on the defensive end. Or does it get to be a situation where, you know, just athletically, because he was never the, you know, the prime, like, peak athlete, does he find himself in a situation where his impact just drastically crashes? And I'm not suggesting it's going to happen even next year, but sometime here in the next couple of seasons, it's going to happen.
Yeah, and it's not completely, like, just his game falling off. I think a lot of it is just wear and tear, and people sometimes don't realize how taxing Draymond's role is, and like, there's a reason that most other players can't pull it off, and let alone pull it off for an entire season or an entire like 4-year stretch like Draymond has. And so it's just something to watch. Real quick though, before we move on, I'll read you the top 15 guys that I did while I was waiting for you to call me. Number one is LeBron. Number two is Steph. Number three is KD. Number four is Harden. Five, Anthony Davis. Six, Giannis. Seven, Russell Westbrook. Eight, placeholder for Kawhi Leonard. Nine, Joel Embiid. 10, Chris Paul. 11, Damian Lillard. 12, Draymond Green. 13, Rudy Gobert. 14, Jimmy Butler. 15, Paul George. What do you think?
That's a pretty good list. I think it's tough because some of these guys have been injured or are currently injured. I mean, don't you think Jimmy, fully healthy, if we're talking only this season, deserves to be higher?
Yeah, maybe, but it's hard to unseat someone like Damian Lillard or like or Rudy Gobert. Chris Paul is the one that like would fall, I guess, but he's still so good. So I don't know. I'm mainly just throwing it out there as fodder for you to think about as you talk to Rob about next year's top 100. It'll be a good conversation.
No, I mean, anyone can make a list. You know, 2 and 3 were dead wrong, but that's fine.
All right, well, let's move on. Before we do, though, we need to talk about Buffalo Wild Wings. It's March, and Buffalo Wild Wings loves a Cinderella story. It's the tale of an underdog, the unexpected, and by their unexpected nature, you just can't predict when one of those Cinderella stories is going to happen. It makes them great, but it also makes them frustrating, because at any moment, you could miss that Cinderella sighting. Unless you're spending March at B-Dubs, the official hangout for NCAA March Madness.
Here, Andrew, you better be spending the entire month of March at B-Dubs. You're going to move in. You're spending the whole month there watching every Cinderella story unfold.
You've been there for the last couple weeks, just living off ranch dressing, right?
I'm broadcasting from the B-Dubs bathroom right now. Hopefully no one flushes any toilets while we're recording.
Yeah, well, listen, you guys can catch every second of every game, and you'll be able to look back and tell the story of the team you watched climbing their way from a low seed to the champions, but only if you go to Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports, UMBC, Michigan's game winner. Get involved, check it out, get some great apps in your life. It's, you know, it's March. Why not?
I mean, dozens of sauces on their wings, Andrew. I mean, every choice you could possibly want, every app, you know, they'll fry anything for you. It'll taste great. Go to B-Dubs for the entire month. Just move in.
Absolutely. All right, let's get back into it. Jake says, let me preface what I'm saying here by saying that I did not get to watch the OKC-Toronto game in its entirety. But looking at the Thunder's box score, one thing is clear. At this stage, Westbrook should really just stop shooting threes at a high volume. He took 1 3 in that game and made it, but then he also dished out 14 assists. Melo, Steven Adams, Corey Brewer, and Jeremy Grant all shot over 50%, while Paul George came in at a respectable 22 points on 42% shooting. And I included this because I think this is a really great point. I think that there's sometimes a correlation between Westbrook's shots and OKC's success, and that doesn't really make sense because like Westbrook has to shoot more in games where they're behind, and so it's sort of like it can be misleading. But I do think that this is one thing that is really true for Westbrook and OKC. When he's taking 4 or 5 threes, or more. I mean, I think he took like 17 threes in their elimination game against the Rockets last spring. Like, it gets to be a little bit dicier for the Thunder offense. And when he doesn't shoot threes and looks to score in other ways and distribute in other ways, like, they can be really, really dangerous.
You know, to be honest, it's really hard to address this question because I had trouble focusing on Westbrook destroying the Raptors because of how badly everyone associated with that franchise was just melting down late in that game. I mean, Westbrook was hitting like game ceiling jumpers, daggers, I mean, all these different shots. He was getting into the paint at will. You know, he was setting up all of his teammates, like Jake mentioned in the email, but it was just really hard to focus. I mean, I was just distracted by all the whistles, technical foul, ejection, Dwayne Casey's being escorted out. Oh, there goes DeMar DeRozan, another late game meltdown from him. Like, I can't even bring myself to really address this question, Andrew. I'm sorry.
You know, it shocks me that we still have listeners who are Raptors fans, because you really never miss an opportunity to take a cheap shot at Toronto. Even
that was bad, though.
Yeah,
Andrew, that was particularly bad, wasn't it? First of all, great game, and full credit to Oklahoma City. I've been hard on them this season, too. That was a big win. Toronto is really tough in that building. They've been amazing all season long. Excellent consistency, especially at home. I mean, I think ultimately at the end of the game, they did lose their composure. They kind of gave that game away. Oklahoma City deserved to win, but Westbrook kind of broke their back. He broke their neck. I mean, that's sort of what he does sometimes. And but the crying over the officiating was just so over the top. I mean, from everyone, including the fan base, just everyone associated with the franchise. And that's one thing I would say, you know, just for Raptors fans, like, that label has hit you. Work hard to push back against it. Do not be the team or the media member or anyone else who goes straight to the officials after every tough loss. I mean, the Raptors have basically lost what, Andrew? Like one game in the last 2 months? Do you have to scream about that loss for the officials for half an hour afterwards? No, you don't. And this label is on. It's been on for multiple years. There's been two labels the Raptors are trying to shake, that they choke in the playoffs and that they whine. They're doing a pretty darn good job shaking that choker label. And we have a lot of rational Raptors fans who will send us emails and they'll kind of apologize on behalf of their fan base. I appreciate that. I'm willing to say this is not a blanket statement applying to every Raptors fan. But if your initial inclination was to scream and cry because DeRozan got tapped on that layup or whatever, wrong inclination. Try to figure out how to shore up your defense so Westbrook is not dicing you guys on every single possession. But in terms of Jake's question, in all seriousness,
yeah,
look, attack mode Westbrook is the best Westbrook. I think we would all agree about that. When he's pulling up and trying to do the off the dribble 3-point stuff and getting desperate and his shot selection wavers, you know, you're living and dying by a mediocre 3-point shooter or sometimes sub mediocre 3-point shooter. That's never really been his weapon. When he's collapsing the paint, when he's forcing, you know, big guys to try to stay with him, he's either getting fouls, he's putting the ball up on the glass so guys like Steven Adams can get second chance points, or he's just driving and dishing, creating really high percentage opportunities. That was a big hole in Toronto's defense. I mean, they really needed Ibaka to go in like a time machine like 3 or 4 years back to sort of prime Ibaka, because he was out there struggling not only with Steven Adams' strength in physicality. I mean, they're wrestling on these free throws, and Ibaka is just getting beat consistently by Adams, but then also with his ability just to track those drives coming into the paint. And I don't think they have any other better options inside than Ibaka at this point for that particular matchup. So, you know, it's a good thing they're not going to have to worry about seeing the Thunder in the finals. But I think Westbrook played a great game. I mean, he really did. And he started very slow, and he's not like back into that MVP conversation. I wouldn't say that, but in terms of players who maybe have become underrated because we were so hard on him earlier in the season, I would actually say Westbrook might be slightly underrated
think
at this
that
point.
He's in that conversation, and I like how little respect you have for both of these teams. It really comes through, and I appreciate it. I love the teams that bring out your true personality and force you to not be a robot, and you just can't help it. You don't really respect either one of these teams. I do think that, like, it has been fascinating to watch because the correlation between less Westbrook threes and better OKC offense has been clear for some time now, and I don't know whether he's just not getting that message from the coaches, whether nobody in OKC can like really control how he plays. But it seems like the clearest blueprint for OKC success. And I hope he sticks with it because it has been more fun. Like, OKC is beginning to reclaim a little dignity. I'm not ready to say that like Corey Brewer is the solution, but he's played pretty well for them. And a competent Thunder team would make the Western Conference playoffs a lot more fun. So hopefully they keep this rolling. I feel like the Thunder and Cavs are two teams who the pendulum swings dramatically back and forth every 3 weeks. So I don't want to get too high here, but they've been playing pretty well.
Yeah, and the Corey Brewer move at the time, do we even talk about it when they picked him up? I mean, that one flew way under the radar. So look, Sam Presti, you know, we're questioning that Carmelo trade a little bit, but we're going to give you credit for Corey Brewer. That was a home run.
Absolutely. Yeah. Billy Donovan, bringing back the glory days of Corey Brewer's career. But moving on and continuing with the bitching about the refs theme, Solomon says, Doc Rivers and Alvin Gentry are each headed for fines after complaining about officiating against the Rockets. I can't help but think that both of these teams have a good chance of playing Houston in the first round. Is this complaining really a way of working the league in advance of the playoffs, or is it just pure frustration? Also, if we're talking about Harden in the clutch, could officiating come back to bite Houston in the playoffs? Two good questions there. What jumps out at you first?
No, great questions from Solomon. I think, first of all, it's kind of a perfect storm because not only are they potential first-round matchups for Houston, and not only does Harden have a way of just getting under everyone's skin with his foul-drawing ability and the types of calls that he gets, and so you're just kind of, you know, usually annoyed after playing him and frustrated by what he could do. But you have two coaches who their teams have been some of the biggest, I guess, you know, valiant type teams this season in terms of overcoming adversity. And there's also two coaches, frankly, whose future in their positions kind of hinge probably on whether they make the playoffs, right? Like maybe not quite as much for Doc, but this is like a perfect storm, just pressure cooker for both these guys. I mean, with Gentry, like, you get into that four seed, you're feeling good about where New Orleans' season is going, and then all of a sudden now you're back on the bubble and they could still miss the playoffs. Like, it's feasible. I mean, that would be a disaster for him, and especially after feeling like you were so close to it given how AD was playing, for them to be on the outside looking in would just be crushing. So anytime you're in that situation, you know, that frustration is going to come out. And he was not only complaining about Harden, he was advocating on Davis's behalf, and I think that's the right thing to do because, you know, Davis probably could get more calls than he does. In terms of the Clippers, you know, I think, you know, Doc's always working some angle. So for sure he could be setting up the playoffs. For sure he could be just, you know, trying to rally his troops and keep them going through what has been a pretty insane season for them health-wise and just, you know, the trade of Griffin and everything else. So I just think there's many factors going on, but Solomon's right to point out a couple of them.
Yeah. My only reaction is that I find myself complaining about the officials in most Rockets games, so I don't blame any coach who, like, hits the post-game presser and starts venting. And I'm honestly surprised that it doesn't happen more often. I think if the Rockets do go on and shock the world and win a title and come back next year as, like, the NBA's gold standard, we're going to hear a lot more whining about the way Harden is officiated, because he does, like, in every game, just get a couple calls that are just baffling. And it is a factor in the playoffs, and we'll have to sort of wait and see. But
let me ask you this. So, you know, you're married, and let's just say you're a coach. Let's say you make $3 million a year, and the fine for going off on the officials is $15,000, right?
Uh-huh.
Obviously, every time you get fined, you're probably going to hear about it at home, right? Like, because that's just money that's being thrown away. But yeah, at the same time, there is some value to this grandstanding, right? My question is this. Make yourself that coach. Let's say, you know, Scott Brooks is out. You're in as the Wizards coach, right? How many times per year do you think you would get fined at $15,000 a pop if you made $3 million a year? How many times would you get fined? And at what point would it be like a conversation? Like, if you got to 10?
conversation with my wife.
Yeah, like, what's, like, your maximum breaking point where you can't justify it anymore? Because I think some of these guys who go through their entire careers without getting any technical fouls, to me, that is just unthinkable. Like, you called me out, like, 5 minutes ago for just flipping out on the Raptors, right? Like, that could have easily been just me, like, as a head coach, flipping out on the refs, and boom, I get fined. And you have to charge that to the game, right? First of all, how many times do you think you would get fined? And then what would be your upper max limit?
I think I would get fined. I think I would err on the side of caution because I like money, and I would be pretty reluctant to just, like, go the Draymond route and get fined $15,000 every 2 weeks. But I think there would be a couple strategic strikes. So I would probably, I put myself down for like 3 or 4 fines through the course of a regular season, but not more than that.
That's respectable.
And I also think that, like, once I hit 5 or 6, there would definitely be a conversation with my wife, and I'd have to sort of, like, tone it down from there.
Yeah, because that's when you're getting into, like, the college tuition category, where she's like, dude, this is $80,000. Well, like, what are you doing?
And keep in mind, I haven't been making $3 million for the last decade. Like, if I were Doc Rivers, where I basically have made, like, all the money I'm going to need from coaching over the last 10 or 15 years, then the conversation changes, and then you just kind of let it fly. Like, Doc is in sort of the Phil Jackson category, where, like, money is no object, and if he's pissed off, he's gonna say what he feels. Whereas, like, I would be closer to, like, the Fred Hoiberg side of the spectrum, so I'd have to be a little bit more careful.
See, this is reminding me of those guys who get like diplomatic license plates, and so they just illegally park everywhere and they just do whatever they want. They flaunt the rules and they say like, "Hey,
Doc,
give me 200 parking tickets. Who cares?" Like, that's what Doc should be doing, right? So
yeah.
I think our moral of this story here, Solomon, is that some of these coaches who have been around the game for 20 years need to be getting fined more. That's what we expect if they want to really
that's
stand up.
That's a great
for
call, unquestionably. All right, so. One more question. Bill says, as a Bulls fan, I have embraced the process this year. Parentheses, Hinkie died for us all. But we were recently thwarted by the league office. Now the Bulls have been beating all the other tanking teams since the All-Star break and have been passed by the Knicks in lottery odds. Recent mock drafts have us getting Wendell Carter, a polished but not franchise-altering player. Should the Bulls spend another season tanking? And if you guys were running a team and needed to rebuild, how many seasons would you plan to spend on tanking? Or would you focus more on drafting and using free agency to build the franchise from there? There's a lot to sort through there. I think we should start by saying that...
Andrew, please summarize your entire philosophy on roster building here in, you know, 60 to 90 seconds.
I just think the first point that we have to make is that the NBA letter to the Bulls was super, super obnoxious because the Bulls were only in a spot where they had to get extreme about tanking because they had been successful earlier in the year. So basically, the NBA is singling them out for winning too much in the middle of the season and then having to bench Robin Lopez for the final 2 months, which honestly, like, Robin Lopez isn't a big part of their future. And we've been over this before. Justin Holiday is one of the worst starters in the NBA and shouldn't have been playing anyways. So I just think that the NBA's tact on that one was pretty hard to defend. And if I were a Bulls fan, I would be pissed off. But it's a good question. I mean, what they do from here is also a good question. So what do you think? Should they tank another year?
Well, I have many thoughts here. First of all, it is so depressing that he did the mock draft and comes up with Wendell Carter, who's like not one of these like top five can't miss stud type players, right?
Right.
Did anyone have a worse season than the Bulls? I think the Bulls had the worst season of all. I mean, because they played it horribly. They allowed that winning streak to go. And when the winning streak was happening, we kept being like, don't worry, Gar will figure this out. They'll shut everybody down. When they tried to do that, the NBA was like, nah, sorry. Like, you guys can't do it. They trade away one of their only good players in Mirotić, but yet they still have not fallen far enough to get themselves in a good position. Now, maybe they just struck gold in the lottery, and that saves them. But if I was a Bulls fan, I would be thoroughly disgusted with how this whole season played out because they could easily look back and say, look, if we had just done the normally stupid thing, if we had just pulled an Orlando Magic, we would have come away with the franchise player. Instead, we wasted an entire year of our lives. None of the young guys really showed to be that good, and we have no direction, no future. So, yes, they have to tank another year. They have no choice, do they? I mean, they're not good enough in terms of their talent to win more than they have or significantly more than they have. I don't love a ton of the players on their roster. I certainly don't like Markkanen as much as you do, but sure, he's like the guiding light here, but I think it's going to be a while until he's able to take you to a winning team. So I guess my overall takeaway here is anything the Bulls would have done would have been better than what they did, basically. I mean,
yes.
If they had just tried to go 0-82 from the start, if they had tried to make, a really half-hearted Hornets-like playoff push, like not trading Mirotić, trying to put the pieces back together, playing all the vets, at least you could kind of sell that. But where they've landed, like right in the middle between like completely pathetic and just atrocious, is pretty much the worst place to be. And congratulations, they're there.
Yeah, I mean, anything the Bulls could have done would have been better than what they did is a good way to sum it up. And certainly how most Bulls fans feel. And I like Bulls fans have hated Bulls management for the last 4 or 5 years with good reason. So I'm not here to like defend Gar or Pax. I do think that what's happened to the Bulls speaks to how screwed up the system is right now. And as far as tanking another year, I think what's also happening is that the market inefficiency for tanking has sort of disappeared. Like, it's different than when the Sixers were doing all this. When Philly was losing, there were maybe two or three teams that were in this tanking conversation, and now there are like nine teams who are just giving up and tearing it all down. And like, so we've been critical of the Bulls, but the Bulls are still awful, and the Bulls still have like 23 wins right now, or 24. And so it's not like they've been like a 34 win team. Like, they're really bad. But the problem is that there are eight other teams who have recognized that this is like the best path for them. And that, I think, complicates their decisions from here. I mean, if I were looking for like the most depressing parts of this season, I would say that like Chris Dunn, who's not really like a long-term factor for them, powered some of the wins in the middle of the year, and it didn't really make sense to win those games. But
what you're trying to say basically is that the Bulls are sort of like the Microsoft Zune MP3 players. Like, Hinkie was the iPod, okay? He was the trailblazer. He invented the strategy, and all of a sudden he makes all the money. He gets Joel Embiid. He gets Ben Simmons. After he got fired, of course, and that strategy was awesome. But then everybody came along with their own MP3 players, and you know, some of you guys are going to be Microsoft Zune, and that's sort of the Bulls. No one's downloading your software. No one's buying your thing at retail. You're just, you know, a failed product that's going to be sitting on shelves for 3 years until your company scraps it.
Right.
That's pretty much how I view the Bulls.
And not only that, let me say this too. I would add though that the Sixers trying to execute their plan today would have more trouble, because there's just more competition at the bottom of the league. And then I also think that like Hinkie's whole plan would have failed if Joel Embiid were not like historically dominant. So even the Sixers blueprint, which is like the success story that's supposedly driving all this, is it, like, was very much a coin flip. Because if it's just Ben Simmons in Philly and Embiid never gets healthy, like, they're at the bottom of the league too.
I hear what you're saying. I agree with the general premise, but specifically, Hinkie was not going to halfway tank. It doesn't matter ugly it got. If Philly had to go 0-82, Hinkie would have suited up himself. He would have suited up guys like you and me. He would have made sure they had the best lottery odds, period. So there's, you know, he was not going to halfway, do that process. And that's sort of what the Bulls are doing. They're halfway tanking, and that's not how you do it. And that's why we're calling it out as so bad. Let me also say this, though. The letter to the Bulls from Adam Silver, that's a symptom. That's not the disease. It's an annoying thing that they have to do, because the true disease is this. Adam Silver has for years adamantly pretended that tanking doesn't exist. So he has to send that letter, right? Like,
yeah.
Because otherwise, what, you know, how does he like have a leg to stand on when he's telling all these teams about, oh, you know, we don't believe tanking exists. We're going to crack down on any team that does it. We're going to find Mark Cuban if he says he's doing it, and so on and so forth. Adam Silver really needs to have a come to Jesus moment. He just needs to come clean and tell all of us at his next press conference, maybe during the finals, like, guys, look, I'm not going to pretend anymore. Tanking really does exist, and I'm going to, you know, unveil some new rules to fix it, right? Like, he just needs to admit that it's gotten really bad, because as we've said over and over on this episode and previous episodes, it's out of control. I mean, 9 or 10 teams, it's a major storyline, and sending a letter does not really address anything. It brings a team maybe into line slightly. But in this case, it actually works against that fan base's interest. And they probably feel singled out. And they're probably thinking, hey, Adam Silver, go send Orlando a letter too. What have they been doing for the last 5 years?
Yeah, that's a good point. And Orlando is actually another team that has sort of halfway tanked and really suffered because of it. I don't know. To answer his second question, I think the debate between tanking and building through free agency depends largely on your market. And if you're in a big market, like the Bulls are not in as horrible shape as they would be if they were in Orlando and never had hope of attracting free agents. And in fact, I don't know why Chicago hasn't signed more free agents over the years, but I think but that's one of the reasons that Adam Silver, like the way to really solve tanking, either institute my tournament that I came up with a couple weeks ago, which would be awesome, or just randomize the lottery. But I think the problem with just randomizing the lottery and giving everyone equal odds is that like some of the small market teams need hope to sell during some of these off years. But I don't know. It's a longer conversation, and I'm sure there's a lot of fans who kind of get sick of it, but it's definitely like it's going to be one of the bigger things that the league needs to figure out how to solve over the next like 5 or 10 years.
Well, look, I mean, you can answer your own question, Andrew, in terms of why no one signs with the Bulls. You're going into a meeting with their ownership group and their front office. Are you signing with them? I mean, if you've got choices,
Chicago,
have you
is
ever
a
heard
great,
anyone say,
great city, man. If I could go in Chicago, like compare it to like Oklahoma City or Sacramento or Charlotte, like Chicago's awesome.
You can live anywhere if you have that kind of money, Andrew, you know, during the off season, and you're working, you're traveling half the time anyway. I just think the same things that we always say about the Knicks in terms of their dysfunction, all those, you know, at the highest levels. And, you know, we're still waiting to see how their current management group, you know, plays things here over the next couple of years. So, you know, accept them from it. But, you know, the Phil Jacksons, the Isaiah Thomases of the world, plus Dolan in the back, all the same criticisms that those Knicks, you know, higher ups get all apply to Chicago too. And I think players can see right through it.
That's fair. All right. Well, let's move on. We got to talk about mattresses real quick. Let us tell you about Mattress Firm. Everyone knows how important stretching is before a big game. Well, Mattress Firm is here to stretch your dollar. Ben, it's a true slam dunk.
They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise. But know this, Andrew, they are more than just mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed. From adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor, they have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite 3-and-D wing. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast to see what deals are happening. mattressfirm.com/podcast.
And I have to assume that every Open Floor listener has already purchased a new mattress from Mattress Firm. But even if you have, purchase another mattress, because they even offer you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection and a 120-night low-price guarantee, so you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch, like Zach LaVine and Justin Holiday for the Chicago Bulls.
Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow. mattressfirm.com/podcast. Hey, Andrew, guess what? You remember how I told you that story about Gavin and his girlfriend up in Canada?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, how, you know, they were quoting mattressfirm.com, you know, ad copy back and forth to each other in a romantic way.
Yeah.
So it turned out that when we released that podcast, happened to be Gavin's birthday, and he thought the whole thing was a setup as a birthday present. So we really made that couple's whole year, Andrew, with our little shout out on the last episode. For everyone else who skipped through it because it was right on the end of the ad copy, don't worry about it. Let's move on to other questions.
That's awesome. All right. Well, we've gone long, so we're going to do two questions and then save the rest for next week. All right. Then we also have to do some podium stuff too. But Kira says, which NBA All-Star could join their current alma mater and give the Wizards a competitive game? I was thinking Draymond because of his obvious versatility, but also because, like Andrew, I have Michigan State winning the championship. I was also thinking Kyrie and Duke. This is a good question. I don't know why we had to use the Wizards as an example here. I think the Wizards are competent enough to handle any college team, even if you add an NBA player. But number one, I'm not trusting Michigan State to do anything after watching them collapse against Syracuse. I may never forgive Tom Izzo for how poorly he managed that game over the final 10 minutes. And the idea of the Wizards losing to Kyrie Irving on a Duke team is truly like the darkest possible timeline for me as a sports fan. So I have to think that like, that's kind of where this is all leading. It does, my sports fandom only gets darker and darker as I go. So sure, Kyrie and Marvin Bagley and Wendell Carter could probably beat the Wizards. I'll admit that.
So I insisted that this question be included because Kiara's email, it just sort of circled you, kind of like a tiger.
So many different
in
losses.
The wild. And eventually going in for the kill and trying to basically say that the Wizards are, you know, on par with a college team, like that gets a slight boost. I mean, I think the obvious answer for like which player we'd want to see in the NCAA tournament with his alma mater would be Anthony Davis, right?
Yes.
I mean, like, and I also just want to use this as a opportunity to point out Anthony Davis at Kentucky was completely ridiculous. He averaged 14 points, 10.4 rebounds, and 4.7 blocks per game, shooting 62.3%. We don't talk enough about that stint in terms of Anthony Davis's sort of like legacy enough as NBA analysts. I'm sure college guys talk about it all the time because it was probably the best year anybody's had in the last decade, but
they don't
4.7
really,
blocks per game.
No,
really?
Yeah, that Anthony Davis year, because it's more talked about as a collective of talent, which it was, obviously. Like, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist was good that year. I think they had Marquise Teague, who was also, got progressively better as the season went on. But it was really, Anthony Davis putting them on his back through that tournament, which isn't true with a lot of guys. Like, I mean, with Duke a couple years ago, they won that title because of Tyus Jones. It wasn't because of Okafor and Justice Winslow, but Anthony Davis was everywhere for that Kentucky team, and it was wild to watch.
Yeah, it's too bad. Maybe if he had stayed 4 years, he could finally get some credit
get
from college
love.
Basketball
yeah,
fans.
Sure.
But anyway, this had me thinking about an alternate question though, because LeBron, obviously he doesn't have an alma mater. And he always reps for Ohio State, but forget that. Uh-huh. I mean, what we've seen over the last month is that LeBron can single-handedly carry four marginal NBA talents over the bad teams of the NBA, but not quite the best teams of the NBA. I mean, that's sort of been the story, right? He just mops up the triple-doubles against the Suns of the world, and he's been taking loss after loss to sort of competent teams. So what's the worst team in college basketball that LeBron could be on and still win the NCAA title? So for example, UMBC, if they're good enough to beat Virginia and you put LeBron on them, they're a 16 seed, right? They'd win the title hands down, correct?
Yeah, probably. I think LeBron would just score 60 points a game, and that would be that.
Okay, so what if he D3? What if we gave him a D3 team and competing I'm serious here. How bad, how much of a handicap do we have to give LeBron so that he can win the NCAA title?
Yeah, D3 might be pushing it, just because some of the D3 guys would have no prayer guarding Michigan State. I got to stop using Michigan State's not beating anyone. Would have trouble guarding Duke, though.
Okay, so... And also, he could get frustrated. We've seen that too. I'm kind of on choke watch for Giannis in terms of when he turns on one of his teammates. Same thing for LeBron.
Choke
I mean,
watch.
There's been a lot of moments.
Yeah,
there's been a lot of moments with LeBron recently where the frustration could bubble
That's
over.
True.
And I think if
we've
you surrounded
seen LeBron
him with
kind of check out when the teammates aren't there. So that might be another factor to watch if we stick him with Williams College or something.
Yeah, because he has to make it through basically, what, six games? They're 40-minute games, so that would play to his favor. He would never have to come off the court. So there wouldn't be the situations where he's, watching the backups blow leads. But I do think after, the seventh consecutive blown rotation and, dunk that he can't stop, he would probably get pretty frustrated. But I think if you played a zone in college, LeBron's the center of the zone defense, and then he just goes one-on-five on offense. I think if you gave him D2 talent, he could still win the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, I believe it. It would depend on the D2 roster, but I'm not going to argue with you. And I think the correct answer to Kiara's question is saying, Anthony Davis and the current Kentucky team, or Anthony Davis and really any Kentucky team at a year, would be the stiffest competition to the rest of the league. Because we can't really play this game with LeBron because he didn't go to college. But Kyrie and Duke, man, that would drive me insane. Next question, though. Lewis says, where would the Jazz be if Gordon Hayward never left? This is an obvious question, but my guess would be they'd be in the mix for the 3 seed or the clear-cut third team in the West. What do you think?
Well, if we're playing the if game, I mean, is Kawhi still not healthy? Is Jimmy Butler still out? I mean, are we doing all that too?
I think Hayward versus Kawhi and the Spurs, I would still probably take Utah in that matchup.
I mean, I guess I would say it this way. What if Gobert never got injured? If you just have Gobert healthy this whole season, even without Hayward, aren't you still the 3 seed if you're Utah?
Yeah, I think the most interesting part of this question is probably whether you think that Donovan Mitchell turns into Donovan Mitchell if Hayward is still there. And the answer is probably no, right? I mean, I think one of the things that's helped Donovan Mitchell grow is he's had kind of the internal green light for the first 5 months of the season, and we've seen him able to work through some of the issues. Like he kind of hit a wall for a couple weeks, and then he's been able to diversify from there. And so I don't know if he would have grown as quickly if they were still running everything through Hayward.
Yeah, that's a good point. An interesting counter, though, is that could have developed as like the exact opposite of the Jimmy Butler, Andrew Wiggins scenario. Like Jimmy is like this, he's just such an overwhelming personality that Wiggins was guaranteed to shrink. And then just these reports about him like muttering to his teammates about he's unhappy to be the third option. Like that was capable of being seen a mile away, right? Like we all saw, you know, Wiggins will not rise to this challenge and Butler will sort of overwhelm him. I almost wonder if Donovan Mitchell would have been irrepressible, though. Like, Hayward's not that Jimmy Butler personality. Like, I wonder if, like, training camp opens and Mitchell just goes straight for Hayward's throat, like, on the first play, right? And he's just trying to dunk on Hayward every single time. He's, like, begging for the defensive matchup. Like, I could kind of see it playing out that way where it's not like he becomes the alpha dog, like, straight off the top, but he's, like, pushing Hayward so hard for touches and rolls and everything else that goes along with that, that they just sort of have this kind of uneasy dynamic where they're kind of sharing the load, and then eventually Hayward, you know, kind of, you know, becomes more of a complimentary player down the road.
That might be
a year or two guy.
Best role, right? Like, I don't think that if Hayward's your best player, I think that there's a pretty clear ceiling. But I think as the second guy next to someone like Donovan Mitchell, he could be awesome.
Yeah, so I could have seen that just taking a couple of years to play out, and maybe it's awkward in the interim and, you know, they're not best buddies and they have to play nice for the media, but then eventually just sort of there's a transition of power there.
Yeah.
And I don't know how this wound up being so bleak towards Minnesota fans. Sorry, guys, but I don't see a similar transition of power taking place between Butler and Wiggins ever.
Yeah, well, we have a quota to fill. Every two or three podcasts, we have to get unreasonably bleak about the future of Andrew Wiggins in Minnesota. Or maybe reasonably bleak, actually. I don't know. One more. I know this is tough because you're a reality-based person, but Which roster would you like more? The Jazz with Donovan Mitchell, Hayward, and Gobert, or the Blazers with CJ McCollum, Damian Lillard, and LaMarcus Aldridge?
I think I would take the Jazz roster because I think Gobert, I mean, you know, you just can lock in elite defense and it's just easier to build from there. And I think Mitchell's got, you know, a lot of upside and Hayward is established in his prime. You know, the fit with Aldridge and Lillard was never perfect. You know, it was solid. I think LaMarcus, kind of because of age, in terms of cores, he might be the weak link there, right? Like, wouldn't you rather just have, you know, a slightly younger core you can build around?
Yeah.
You know, with a cleaner fit. I mean, Gobert, he doesn't have the versatility, but you know exactly how you're going to play with him. And it does make things easier because you can, you know, bring on gunner guards if you wanted to, because he's going to clean up the mess behind them. And they have chosen not really to do that. You know, they have, you know, tons of defensive-minded players on that roster, but it wouldn't be that hard to build around that core you're laying out in Utah. I think it'd be easier.
Yeah, well, I hope they get one more star in Utah because, man, that team is fun. But podium here. Muse says, you guys really dropped the ball with the deserted island question on last week's podcast. First of all, the two worst players to be stranded with would be Kobe Bryant and Dwight Howard. And as far as the best player to be stranded with, the correct answer is obviously Steven Adams. And that's a great point on both counts, okay? I can't believe we overlooked Dwight because he is someone who I could see myself just trying to swim for it after like a couple days stranded with Dwight. And then as far as Steven Adams, like, we both dropped the ball on that one. He's clearly the best guy to be stranded with. He's one of the only NBA players that I could see, like, literally chopping down a tree. And he would also have great stories. He'd have a nice sunny outlook as we were both stranded. I think he'd be awesome.
Yeah, good. I mean, I can see you strapping all of your food to your body and swimming towards the shark-infested waters to get away from Dwight
exactly.
Howard. It's like dinner time.
It would be brutal.
Yeah, no, good nominations. I mean, I thought my answer was pretty good. I don't know why Muse says I dropped the ball. Come on, Muse. Like, I had pretty good answers.
Look, you did. Manu and Vince would be great. I just don't know if they would be like half as useful as Steven Adams. Like, Steven Adams is someone who, even if we couldn't build a raft, like, I could see myself just like hopping on his shoulders and him somehow like walking through the ocean to take me to like to shore or back to civilization. Like, I like my chances, whatever the situation is with Steven Adams.
Maybe the most adorable thing you've said. Okay. like you want to be like a little like tyke on a big Steven Adams' shoulder.
I
sound
think
great.
That's the issue is we're all little tykes compared to Steven Adams and maybe Boban too is in that conversation. But
well, here's my issue with this though. I mean, let's say you were really stranded on a deserted island right now. Just be honest. Are you rushing back to civilization at this point?
No, that's chilling. That's a really good point. Yeah, maybe I am just living out the rest of my days with Vince Carter and Manu.
See, what I think I would do if I was in this situation is I would tell the NBA player that I was a raft-making expert, and hopefully it's like Vince or Manu. It's like one of these guys who you actually want to hang out with, and I'd just be milking it forever. Be like, oh, yeah, you know, we have to wait till March when the trees are just right. That's when I'm going to build a raft. You know, we have to have just a certain type of wood. I would not be in any hurry whatsoever to get back to civilization. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, particularly if we could hook up some sort of, like, Wi-Fi situation to where I could watch basketball. Like, I don't know. I think about moving to, like, the west coast of Ireland like way too frequently these days. As long as I could get, like, a satellite dish, I'd be fine. But moving on, another follow-up to last week's podcast, and Steven Adams is from New Zealand, so this is perfect. Rachel says, Lord of the Rings, more like Board of the Rings. That was me. that was Rachel at 11 years old explaining to her dad why Harry Potter was far superior to Lord of the Rings. And I really appreciate it. I got a lot of positive feedback from Dumbledore's army. Hey. It was solid.
Look, this is so unrepresentative. I mean, if it's bad to just judge Draymond Green off one game against the Kings, it is terrible that you tried to frame this Lord of the Rings conversation off the one email that was somewhat
Rachel.
You threw him a huge life raft, Rachel, because we had at least 20 or 30 emails basically saying, I mean, I think the prevailing theme from your take that Harry Potter was better than Lord of the Rings was that people made a point to say, I have never emailed any podcast. I have never interacted with a podcast host in my entire life. I hope to never interact with a podcast ever again. But I need to tell you, Andrew, you are so flagrantly wrong about Lord of the Rings that it bothers me to my core. That we got that email like 20, 30 times.
Yes. Well, look, we got maybe 10 to 20% support and then 80%. Half of them were not even willing to engage. They were just like, I'm not even going to address Sharp's Lord of the Rings take. But the other half was closer to this, which was Bo, who said, calling Lord of the Rings a shittier version of Harry Potter is the worst take I've ever heard on any podcast about any subject. And I just want to say this, okay? I thought about it after the last podcast we recorded, and honestly, I regret nothing. If there's anything I regret, wow, it's that I apologized to Lord of the Rings fans, because after thinking about it some more, I have a couple fronts on which Lord of the Rings is clearly inferior. Number one, Dumbledore is a much, much cooler wizard than Gandalf. Like, if Gandalf ever tried to step to Dumbledore, it would be a disaster. And Dumbledore's winning that series in five. And then continuing on, Bellatrix and Dolores Umbridge and the Malfoy family are much better villains than anyone in the Lord of the Rings universe. We don't even have to talk about Voldemort, he who shall not be named, but he's also superior too. Sirius Black / Gary Oldman is much cooler than Viggo Mortensen's like uncle character as he takes care of Frodo. Hogwarts is far superior to the Shire. I was watching that movie with my wife, and again, I've only seen the first like 45 minutes of Lord of the Rings before I got bored and turned it off.
Oh my god! But,
my wife was like, "Oh, look, it's the Shire. It's so cool." And it turns out the Shire is just a shittier version of Hogwarts. So, and then the final point Hermione is a straight-up legend, and she basically saves the world riding shotgun with Harry Potter. And Lord of the Rings has no real female counterpart to Hermione. Like, Liv Tyler is not on that level. And really, that was probably the biggest reason I was bored with Lord of the Rings. It's just a bunch of weird male elves fighting over a ring while Hermione is out here running things with her bottomless purse. And she's awesome. So if it's even close, which it's not, I feel like Hermione is the clear tiebreaker between Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter.
Do you know what that was like, Andrew?
What?
That was like someone saying, I know I've only watched the dunk contest, but I think Harold Miner is a better version of Michael Jordan. That's what that sounded like to
what
me.
What I like about this, to be honest, though, I think that it's clear that you're a closet Lord of the Rings fan.
No, that's not clear at all. When you were breaking down the Wizards, I was like, oh my God, I might have to quit this podcast. I've never felt that before. I've never had that feeling. Andrew, I'm a reality-based person. Neither one of them mean anything to me. They're not real. And yet, it seems like there's a certain reverence given to the Lord of the Rings books, right?
Right.
Like you're talking movies, and I think that's probably why you're angering some people, but like, wouldn't you suggest or like agree with the suggestion that the Lord of the Rings books, because of their sort of like place in history, maybe they're like the Bill Russell of the fantasy genre. I don't know. I'm not great at making these comparisons, but I feel like those have a special place, right? So when you're attacking them, you're just begging for more people to just throw and just rain hate down on you in our emails with these comparisons,
well,
aren't you?
Absolutely. And you're right that the most common criticism we received over the last week or so was that Harry Potter is clearly derivative of Lord of the Rings, et cetera, et cetera. And look, if that's the leg you have to stand on, then I'm right, okay? Because if that's the best argument you have, that's like saying the 96 Bulls are clearly derivative of the 68 Celtics. Like, great. That doesn't mean that they, like, the 68 Celtics could hang for four quarters with Jordan and Pippen and Rodman. Like, sorry. And so that's where I come down. It's like, sure, Tolkien kind of like laid out the blueprint, but then Harry Potter and Hermione and Dumbledore came through and really like took it up another level.
Okay. Reddit.com/Frodo. I need you guys to come in big here. Transcribe everything that Andrew said. Put it on the
Please
website.
Don't.
Let's
Please
have
don't.
Everybody blast off on him with the real reasons why Lord of the Rings is better than Harry Potter. And please,
look,
send out your more detailed, extensive breakdowns to openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. I've already committed to reading every word that people will send in. I'm even going to read these takedowns of you, Andrew. I feel like you're backed into a corner you do not want to be in.
I own all of it because I'm right. And honestly, I don't even think we're going to need to continue discussing this because there's just no argument. You know, if you're repping for Frodo and Bilbo, you're just wrong. But I do encourage you to check it out. The first two Harry Potter movies are like legit kid movies.
I'm good, bro.
But they get good.
I'm good.
All right. Well, listen, on that note, we will come back later in the week, either Thursday or Friday. We have some scheduling issues, but we'll be back at some point later this week. And we will address, we've got like another 15 awesome questions here for the rest of the week. And Ben, until then, take it easy, man.
Thanks, Andrew. Everyone, don't forget, 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. They really help. Load up Open Floor's page, scroll down, hit 5 stars, tap and rate. It's that easy. It takes seconds. Openfloormail@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, concerns, fantasy genre defenses. Andrew, until later this week, I will talk to you.
All right, man. Peace.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.